Carl Sauter remembers the night he lost control, a night several years before he became a successful TV scriptwriter. He was watching a particularly mindless episode of Three's Company when he screamed at his television, "I can write that junk." And as he sat down at the typewriter, he asked himself, "But is it really so easy to write that badly?" Carl Sauter was one of the lucky ones. He not only broke into TV, he became the story editor of one of TV's best-written, most innovative programs, Moonlighting. In 1986, he won a Writers Guild Award for the episode The Dream Sequence Always Rings Twice. That's the one where David and Maddie dream that they're a trumpeter and singer back in the 1940s. In 1988, Sauter won another Writers Guild Award for the episode It's a Wonderful Job. Now he's writing screenplays. Lots of viewers yell at their TVs the same words Sauter once yelled at his. For these hopeful writers, Sauter has written the book How to Sell Your Screenplay, The Real Rules of Film and Television. He also lectures on the same subject at the American Film Institute. Carl Sauter, welcome to Fresh Air.
So the first thing, thank you for having me
on. The first thing I have to ask you, is it easy to write that badly? What do you think?
No, it's not at all. The number one message I try to give to writers and to viewers is don't be fooled by how bad so much of our film and television is. That's not how people get into the industry. You have to write better than what you see on the screen.
So how come what we see on the screen isn't as good as people are capable of writing?
Because it's such a collaborative process. Every movie you've seen or every television episode goes through a lot of steps before the final product is made. Often there was a good idea or there was even a pretty good script somewhere along the way. But because this is such a collaborative form, it's very hard to keep the sort of essence of a script intact. And what often happens is that they tend to fall apart in every rewrite.
Before we get to talking about your experiences on Moonlighting, I'd like for you to unravel some of the mysteries of television for us and explain some of the things that we see. Most TV shows have certain formulas, and they seem to follow just a certain formula from week to week. The opening's very similar, the closing's very similar. You can predict what the character is going to do. This is intentional, isn't it?
It is. We try not to use the word formula because it implies that, you know, it's, you just cut it out of a cookie cutter every week. But it is an F word. The word is franchise. The principle behind most of our television is that viewer loyalty is very important, and that on every show there are certain givens every week that an audience tunes in to see. For example, if you watch Murder, She Wrote, you expect a crime. You expect, you know, five suspects for it, and you expect that Angela Lansbury will figure out some clever way to solve the mystery. That becomes the franchise of the show. The challenge for a writer is within those limits to be real original and real clever, and that's where our television tends to fall apart.
Do most television shows have Bibles where they spell out what the characteristics are of all the characters on the show?
They're supposed to. It's very helpful if you're a freelance writer coming in to pitch ideas. It's very important to know what you can and can't do with a character, and it's not always apparent just from watching the show. A lot of it's very subtle. I mentioned Murder, She Wrote. On that show, one of the biggest problems they have, for example, is getting Angela Lansbury into the story because they don't want her to be a meddler. So she can't come charging in and say, "I'm going to solve this mystery." She has to be pulled into it. That's why she has all those damn relatives.
That's right. Oh, she sure
they
does.
Need a way. They need a way to get her into the story. That's the kind of background that writers need to have before they try and write for a show.
Why are dramas 1 hour and sitcoms 1/2 hour?
It's a great question. Nobody, I think, can really answer it well. There has historically been this belief that you can't be funny for more than half an hour on television. Of course, feature films belie that because, you know, feature films have to be funny for 2 hours. That really has only started to change in the last few years, and Moonlighting was really one of the first shows that sort of crossed the line between comedy and drama in 1 hour. At the time that Moonlighting came on, there was another show called Crazy Like a Fox. And the first time that both shows were eligible for the Emmys, there was enormous brouhaha about what category they were going to be in. Because up until then, there had never really been an hour show that had that much comedy in it.
Are there any rules of thumb about the number of laughs per show you're supposed to have if the show is funny?
Yes, in half-hour sitcoms, they call it the rule of three, which it's an informal rule, but not all that informal, that there should be three laughs per page. Now, a page in a situation comedy is about 45 seconds. That's very hard to do, to be funny three times and tell a story.
Well, isn't the rule of three also that you're supposed to build on that one joke two other times?
Yes. And it's interesting. An awful lot of screenwriting comes in threes. Lists are funnier in threes. And yes, in the build on a joke, one of the old comedy principles is that something is funny once, it's even funnier the third time. But it has to keep building. You can't do the same joke over and over. You have to go, you know, good, better, best. And that's the comedy rule of three.
Here's one of the mysteries to me. Why are there still laugh tracks? Everybody's hip to them. Everybody knows that these people laughed years ago and are probably dead now, although their laughter has been recorded. Everybody understands how it's supposed to operate on them. I don't know of anybody who likes laugh tracks. I know they've been eliminated on some shows, yet they're still on lots of others.
They are, and it's real frustrating because it is an artificial device to sort of point out where the jokes are, and I think it really hurts the writing. I've not worked on a show that has a laugh track, so I've actually never had the experience of having people laugh too loudly at something that I wrote. But I think part of it is because a lot of times our television scripts are so bad, people aren't sure which parts were supposed to be funny. And one of the things that a laugh track does is kind of point out, oh, that was funny. I think it's not a good device, and I applaud the move away from it on an awful lot of shows.
I always wonder on the particularly bad episodic TV shows whether the producers like the show or whether they're very, very cynical people who think, well, I don't like this, but I know those dumb listeners out there will.
Unfortunately, there's an enormous amount of cynicism, and it's a very prestige-oriented industry. So when you work on one of the critically acclaimed shows, you feel better about yourself, you feel better about your writing, you get more reinforcement. I don't think anybody sets out to make a bad television episode or sets out to make a bad movie, and there are just as many bad movies out on a daily basis as there are television shows. What happens is that for whatever reasons, in the process of putting it together, something that could have been good deteriorates. That's the great mystery of this industry. It's very hard to understand how some projects end up being so good and others end up just consistently being so bad.
My guest is Carl Sauter, and he was the story editor for Moonlighting during its first 2 years, and he won two Writers Guild Awards for his scripts. He's also the author of the book How to Sell Your Screenplay. Let's talk about your experiences on Moonlighting. Now, you had explained to us what a franchise is, that it's basically the plot rules and the characterization rules for a series. Did Moonlighting have when you started at the beginning, right?
Yes, I was not there for the first few episodes, but I was a story editor for basically the first season and a half once they knew that Moonlighting was going to go on for a couple of years. And it had some very definite rules. The major one was, and it was great training as a writer, the major one was be very inventive within the limits established by the show. So, for example, in the first season, only had three characters to work with, Maddie, David, and then Miss DePesto. Anytime our stories started to rely too much on outside characters, Glenn Caron, who created the show, would pull us back from that, saying those guest characters are not what this show is about. We had an informal rule that if you got to a story where you were introducing more than three guest characters in a week, we weren't going to be able to spend enough time with Maddie and David, and so we went through and started cutting out the extra characters to get down to the story.
Moonlighting was one of the first shows in what I think is still a trend, and that is that the two main characters have a sexual attraction for each other, but they never consummate it. Now, Maddie and David have since consummated, but
yes.
but there was at least a couple of years in which, you know, that was so much of the plot twist every week, was that you could tell they were really interested in each other, but they resisted. Was this a conscious thing in the story?
Oh, very conscious decision.
What was the rationale behind it?
Well, when Glenn first sold the idea for Moonlighting, he sold it as Cheers with Murder. And so it was very much the same sort of ongoing tension between the two main characters as in Cheers. Remington Steele had a very similar sort of setup for mm-hmm. the show. The problem is it's very hard to sustain that. For those people out there who are Cheers fans, and I think it's consistently one of the best written shows on television, they had the same problems Moonlighting did in the second season. They could not decide whether to consummate or not to consummate. Because once you've done that, it's very hard. You can't go back. You've got to find other things to do with the characters. And yet you feel real guilty week to week, sort of teasing the audience. And you fear that people are going to get bored with that. So while it was a very intriguing way to start the show, it's also the thing that a long term probably most hurt the show, because it was unclear where to go with it.
So you'd have philosophical discussions from week to week?
Whether they should get together or not. Yes, in terms of because you feel a great responsibility to an audience. There's enormous loyalty. And when you're on a hit show like Moonlighting, you really hear from people a lot. I mean, you get everything we did. I mean, good or bad. I mean, it felt like we knew about it very quickly from the people who watched the show. I had left, but in the infamous episode where Maddie got married, I mean, they literally knew within 24 hours of that episode that in terms of its public support, it had been a disastrous decision to make. And the next day after it aired, they started the process of untangling it.
That's right. Another innovation of Moonlighting was that Maddie and David, and this is, of course, the Sybil Shepherd and Bruce Willis character, they address the audience and acknowledge that they're characters in a television program. Whose idea was it to do that?
That was Glenn Caron's idea, and it came about not out of any brilliant creative decision. It came about because it was a gigantic hole in the plot of the first episode where it was done, and we didn't know what to do. We were always way behind. We did not have time to rewrite the script or refilm things. And Glenn said, we're just going to have David turn to the audience and say something, and people will be so stunned they'll never notice that there was this gigantic hole in the plot. And of course, that's exactly what happened. And that then became part of the franchise for the show, that once or twice every episode, usually David would turn to the camera and sort of acknowledge that he was in a television show.
Was it a plot hole that you were responsible for?
Well, it was kind of a group plot hole. As I remember, it was an episode in which we were never really decided if a particular character got killed or not.
This could be a problem.
It could be a problem. But interesting, you know, we got all this incredible fan mail and all these phone calls about how brilliant it was that David turned to the camera. We never got a letter about that huge hole in the plot. So it was a very interesting lesson in sort of diverting an audience's attention.
Well, I think it's very rare that a producer of a television show will suggest that you do something as unusual and innovative as that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the great treats of working on Moonlighting, was that originality got rewarded. We used to sit in our story meetings, and Glenn would say, you know, I don't want sixes. I don't want, you know, mediocre ideas. I want tens. You know, give me things that are really inventive and really different. The one way that you will not fail on the show is by taking risks. And that was a wonderful attitude to sort of, you know, cut my teeth on in television.
How close to deadline were your scripts written?
After. I mean, we were literally writing scripts at some points that where they were shooting. I wrote on Moonlighting with a terrific partner, a woman named Deborah Frank. And in one famous episode, we were sitting at the typewriter writing the scene. And Glenn came rushing into the room and said, we've run out of material on the set. Give me that. And halfway through the scene, he just pulled it out of the typewriter and himself ran it down to deliver to the set. You really can't cut it any closer than that.
Is this one of the reasons why Moonlighting ended up having so many reruns?
Exactly. Because we tended to be so far behind on the scripts, we just could not get them done in time to do new episodes. Just to shoot an episode takes 7 working days. So, you know, you cannot, in our television, not to mention the editing and the casting and all the mechanics that go into every hour of television. So what happened was, as soon as we fell behind on the scripts, we could just never catch up. And every year the show worked real hard to try and, you know, do it right from the beginning. But there's a real tendency in television, because it's such a pressure cooker, to fall behind. And Moonlighting was as bad at that as anyone.
You know, by the way, Moonlighting's moving to Sunday nights now, and they're advertising 7 episodes in a row without reruns.
I know. I was saw it on the Academy Awards, and I was just laughing hysterically, because it's pretty sad when you're at a point where you
have to promo
a show by saying, no reruns, 7 new episodes. It'd be very interesting to see what happens. I have a lot of affection and obviously owe a tremendous debt to the show. It may, though, be a victim of a larger problem in our television, which is whenever we buy a series, we buy it for 5 years. It's very hard to sustain the quality of a show over that length of time. That's why most of what you see tends to fall apart in the second or third year. Moonlighting is a good example of a show that probably would have benefited from how the Europeans do television, which is they buy a particular number of episodes and that's it. And Moonlighting probably would have been a terrific show for a year or 2 years. But, you know, our system, unfortunately, is always looking for the long-running show.
Let's talk about one of the episodes that won a Writers Guild Award, and I'm thinking of the black and white episode, The Dream Sequence Always Rings Twice, and part of this is set in a 1940s nightclub where Maddie's a singer and David is a trumpeter. Was this your idea to do this kind of a dream flashback?
It was actually a homage type of thing. I mentioned my partner on Moonlighting, Deborah Franken. It was actually her idea, and it was an idea that she had pitched to other shows, and people looked at her like she was mad. And our very first meeting with Moonlighting, I just thought it was a great idea. And we went in and pitched it to Glenn, and he went nuts over it. And that actually is the episode that got us our very first job with Moonlighting.
How did you pitch the episode?
We pitched it very simply. A lot of what I try and do in the book is talk about the real way that it works. When you watch bad film or television, people get fooled. They think that complicated plots and lots of elaborate effects are really what screenwriting is about, and that's not true. Good screenwriting is good storytelling, and in the case of that episode, the story that we told was very simple. We wanted Maddie and David to get preoccupied with a murder that happened in the 40s, and then in separate dreams become the characters as a way to act out the tension in their relationship set in the 40s. It was really pitched that simply and that directly. We talked about the possibility of doing it in black and white, which Glenn was a huge fan of that notion. He also very much liked the idea that both Bruce and Sybil would get a chance to be involved in music. So it was an idea that just sold immediately as soon as we started talking about it.
Now, you were story editor for 2 years on Moonlighting. What does that mean exactly?
Well, a story editor is a staff writer. It's one of the things you try and do if you write television because it's very hard to sustain a career as a freelancer. Freelancers move around from one show to another. And being staff on a show means that you have a steady income and you're very much involved in the whole process of a show. Basically, what a story editor does is meet with writers, look at writing samples, sit in on sessions where writers come in and pitch their ideas, and also rewrite scripts. We would often work with scripts that other writers had done, and we would redo the scenes or redo the dialogue to try and improve it.
You have heard, I'm sure, lots of people pitch story ideas, and I think that's probably taught you about the mistakes people make and the wrong ideas that they have about how television gets made. When you were doing Moonlighting, what were some of the most commonly pitched ideas?
We had a list. I was astounded because I had never sat on that side of the process before where you met with writers all day long and heard their ideas. And the first message that comes across is people are incredibly unoriginal. You are thrilled when a writer comes in and tells you a story you haven't heard before. For people who are interested in this as a possible career, the first advice that I give is to don't sit down and come up with movie ideas and don't sit down and come up with TV ideas. If we've seen it 100 times in film and television, it is no longer a good idea. It's not an original idea. The stories that were most often pitched at Moonlighting were Maddie and David are trapped, you know, in an elevator shaft, on a boat, in the Xerox room, you know, in a mountain cabin. And every writer would talk about this idea like it was the most amazing original story we'd ever heard. So much so that we finally started to say to writers before they came in, please don't pitch Maddie and David are trapped. The problem with that as a story idea is that it can't go anywhere. Maddie and David are trapped, they fight, they make up, they fight, they get out. There's no surprises in the story, which means that it's a story that's not well structured for film or television.
Have you had to deal with standards and practices a lot? Did you have things that were changed at the suggestion
Yes.
of the networks?
Yeah, very much so, particularly on moonlighting, because one of the great joys for moonlighting was to see how far we could stretch the rules. And one of the advantages of doing scripts at the last minute is often the network didn't have time to get the jokes before they were on the air, whereas if we had given them the scripts a month ahead of time, they may have kind of finally figured out, gee, that's a pretty dirty joke, and we're not going to let that on. That whole process in the industry has really changed dramatically, and just in the last few years, it used to be when you did a script, you got back notes on all your lines, and they would trade two dams for a hell and all of that. That whole process has gotten much more liberal, and there are really only a very few things you can't do on television now.
What are they?
So, a couple of those four-letter words haven't quite crossed over, though. I mean, I was astounded just this year. If you look at some of the words like bitch that are now common in most screenplays, even 2 or 3 years ago, you could not put that into a script. So I think the audience can guess the couple that haven't made it onto the list yet.
You reprint some of the notes that Standards and Practices sent down to the writers of Soap. And Soap was a sitcom a few years ago with Billy Crystal in it. And it was one of the first sitcoms to have a recurring gay character on it. And these are pretty interesting. I'm just going to read a couple of the notes that were sent back. Delete the word slut. Delete the word fruitcake. Please ensure that Benson's self-effacing portrayal is always played tongue-in-cheek and that he continues to stay one-up vis-a-vis his antagonists. In order to be able to treat the mafia storyline here and throughout, it will be necessary to introduce a principal, continuing character of Italian descent who is very positive and who will, through the dialogue and action, balance and counter any negative stereotypes. And then in order to treat Jody as a gay character, his portrayal must at all times be handled without limp-wristed actions or other negative stereotyping. You know, a few of the notes in here are about objectionable language, but most of the notes in here are about stereotypes and how they fear they might be offending a segment of the community that would be viewing.
Very much so. You make a great point, because there is another side to Standards and Practices, which is to try and not promote stereotypes and cliches. A lot of what Soap did, of course, was make fun of the whole form of the soap opera. And so the soap opera has had a tendency to have cliched characters, and as a result, Soap sometimes lapsed into making what in the network's eyes constituted making too much fun of those characters. So that's a fairly responsible side of the industry. The problem you have as a writer is sometimes the anti-clichés become the clichés, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, the super black character, the black mom who does everything, you know, those. In this day and age, you have to be very careful as a writer to offer real characters as opposed to clichés one way or the other.
You were so anxious to break into television. It seems to me shortly after you got in, you got out.
I know. I'm a shallow kind of guy. What can I say? Television was very hard. The being on staff for me was just an incredible grind. I had a whole nother career that I talk about in the book, and that I was in, of all things, government for 15 years. And I had been on moonlighting for a week, my first staff job, and I walked into the executive producer's office and I said, "This is why I left government. All I do is have meetings, deal with politics, you know. I left working in government so I would never have to talk to the city council again. And here I am, in effect, talking to a city council, pitching story ideas. It's the same process." I was astounded. The reason that I became a writer was to write and to have more time by myself. And what I found being on staff on a show was it was exactly the same process I had been through in the city of Pasadena. I also, Deborah and I, were very lucky because it's very hard to move from television into feature films, and we started getting feature film offers early on in the process at Moonlighting, and it was a step that I really wanted to make, and so we finally decided to leave the show to do that.
Now, one of your screenwriting credits, although it wasn't credited on the screen, is you did one of the rewrites for My Stepmother is an Alien.
I was one of 12 writers on that poor film, and Deborah and I did. We were right in the middle of it. What people often don't realize is that there are lots and lots of writers whose names you'll never see, who somewhere along the way in the process of a movie, either did a draft or were involved. That film was a classic example of something I was saying at the beginning, of a movie that sort of fell apart along the way. The version of the script that we were handed was a pretty terrific script with a lot of substance to it. It had very little to do with the movie that they ultimately made. So for writers who think, oh, I could write my stepmother as an alien, the part of the process they don't see is that they would have to write a better script than that to get into the industry.
It seems like it would be a whole lot more direct to just write bad scripts and sell them.
Well,
rather than
writing
good ones
be.
And then water them down.
And unfortunately, that's one of the hardest messages to get out to writers. It was one of the hardest things for me to learn. It took me 6 years of working very hard to get into this industry. One of the biggest mistakes I was making along the way is that I was writing at the level of what I saw, not understanding that you have to write better than that to get into the industry. Most of the episodes that are on most television series, if they had been submitted as writing samples, those writers probably would never have gotten in the door. The sort of rule of thumb is that a lot of good scripts in this industry don't get made, but good writers always get noticed because there just are not that many of them.
Do you think that television is on the whole getting any better or getting any worse?
I have to say it's getting better. I think if you look at the schedule now versus the schedule of 10 years ago, there is more variety, there are more interesting kinds of shows. It's a hard medium to improve quickly. The progress in television tends to be measured by little bits here and there. There was no such thing as a Wonder Years even 4 years ago. There was no such thing as an L.A. Law 10 years ago, pre-Hill Street Blues. So that I think that there's a lot of good news happening on television. I feel the same way about feature films. I look at the last year's crop of films, and for the first time, I think films began to skew more to an adult audience. So I'm generally pretty upbeat about that. You're going to increasingly see improvements in the quality.
Well, Carl, I want to thank you a lot for telling us about writing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.